You may know you're listening to this show along the Marketing Podcast Network, but did you know there are other great shows on MPN to help your business? Christy Hyler hosts a fantastic podcast called Own It. Christy, tell us more about the show.
Own It is all about celebrating women and non-binary advertising agency owners. We talk about buying out of the Boys Club of Advertising because less than 1% of ad agencies are owned by women.
And where can people subscribe?
You can find the podcast at untilyouownit.com. We're also on the Marketing Podcast Network at marketingpodcast.net. And of course, you can subscribe wherever you get your podcasts.
You heard her. Go subscribe.
I'm Nick Westergaard, and this is On Brand, helping you tell your story. My guest this week is Ryan Hogan.
Because at the end of the day, like when we talk about brand, and I think this is where a lot of people get confused, because when you think about brand, you immediately go to marketing. Brand is how a name or how a trademark or how something from a company makes you feel, which transcends marketing.
Ryan is co-founder and CEO of Hunt-A-Killer, an innovative gaming company that delivers clues, items, and correspondence to your doorstep that creates an interactive and immersive story for its members. Ryan enlisted in the United States Navy in 2002 and was selected for the Seaman to Admiral Commissioning Program in 2008. He commissioned and graduated from the University of Maryland with a business degree focused on marketing and management in 2013. Ryan separated from active service in 2017 and entered the U.S. Navy Reserves when he decided to pursue entrepreneurship full-time. He currently serves as a surface wartime officer in the U.S. Navy Reserves and CEO of Hunt-A-Killer. To date, Hunt-A-Killer has sold over 1 million boxes, surpassed 100,000 subscribers, and has doubled revenue 2 years in a row without outside investors, with continued growth expected. Ryan, welcome to On Brand.
Awesome. Thanks for having me.
Absolutely. Well, first of all, I thank you for your service. And you have a couple of lifetimes packed into that bio, whether it's the high growth entrepreneur or your Navy service. I think, again, could be a couple different folks. That aside, I do have to say, I get a lot of pitches for podcast guests, and I not all of them are on the up and up. Some aren't quite a right fit for talking about branding and marketing. And I did a double take when I saw the word killer in my inbox. I thought, what is this? Is this but this is a really interesting concept. So I think for a level set, lest we confuse anyone else, now that we've given your bio, what's the elevator pitch of Hunt-A-Killer?
Yeah, for sure. And you know, what's really funny about your comment with the name Hunt-A-Killer is it's extremely awkward, especially once I separated from service in 2017. It's really awkward to walk into like a doctor's office and fill out those new patient forms. And then when it asks for your company to write Hunt-A-Killer. So you're not the only one that that gives a questioning look when you see the name. But, you know, a quick background or what Hunt-A-Killer is, you know, we're an immersive storytelling company. And really, today, what that boils down to is we ship out a product, and we ship out episodes that have clues, items, and correspondence. And so basically, we build these vast universes, and we immerse our members into them through actual physical items. So instead of watching a television show or going to the movies, which obviously is not happening right now, you know, instead we deliver an immersive experience right to your doorstep where the story unfolds through physical items.
And I think that's what's fascinating, because at first it's funny. There's kind of I'm just giving you a blow by blow of my response learning about your business, which is which may be a strange interview, or it might be anecdotal market research. But at first I thought, okay, so it's a game, but then you're also a part of this subscription box industry that there is, you know, whether it's pets with BarkBox or, you know, basically there's all kinds of services that are into that category. But one that's immersive storytelling and entertainment is very different. I can't think of anything else like this out there right now.
Yeah, and I think about for us, it's really because when we think about the subscription box industry, for instance, we look at it as a business model. You know, for instance, another business model of ours is retail distribution. And so in 2 weeks, we'll be on the shelves of Target. We're already selling on Amazon. And so, you know, the subscription box portion of this is really a business model. And all the business model is something that facilitates the transaction of what we actually do. And, you know, at the heart of what we do is we bring people together around immersive entertainment. And so, you know, really when we think about subscription boxes and retail distribution, you know, those are just business models for us to be able to distribute our immersive storytelling products.
And you're also a beneficiary of a couple of confluence of events here with America's interest in true crime. Seems like it's never been higher. I'm a big fan of true crime podcasts and docuseries and things like that. I always feel like not unlike your doctor's office form story, that when my wife looks at my podcast, it could be a very disturbing lineup of things. But also, so there's that, but there's also this time where, as you alluded to earlier, we can't go to movies. You know, and that competes for entertainment, and people have, you know, are binging everything at home, and we're looking for something different. You see people playing games and doing something like this. It seems like it is, if there was a time for immersive at-home storytelling, it seems like right now it is very much a time, well, to hunt a killer.
Yeah, I agree, and you know it's been coincidental this year that in the middle of a pandemic we're really starting to get the attention, because this has been a hyper growth company over the past 3 years, where you know we've been experiencing 100% year-over-year growth for the past 2 years. We were just number six on the fastest growing company list. And we're on pace to double again. So it's been very interesting, kind of that acceleration towards our vision of bringing the world together around immersive experiences, because the world needs it right now. You know, anything that can provide escapism, distraction, or strengthen the relationships around it. And also to be able to do that from your own home, I agree with you. You know, it's been a very timely and a very exciting time for us to really kind of realize that vision.
Well, and it's you know, it gives people something different than sourdough bread,
right? Exactly.
for people that might find that a little more laid back and might want something here, so take us back to where this idea came from, because this is very unique. It is a confluence of a few different things. What made you think that people might want to hunt killers from the home?
For us, it's been it's been all about a journey, and you know, entrepreneurship, it has been about understanding what, especially Derek and I, my co-founder, what our ultimate goal is, and using businesses as vehicles to achieve those goals. And so, you know, as a quick, for instance, you know, that 12 years ago, I was selling T-shirts, performance apparel called Warwear. And if you would ask me 10 years ago, where do you think you'll be in 10 years? I would have said a multi-billion-dollar performance apparel company. And you know, the reality is today we're shipping amazing immersive experiences, and I never would have saw that coming. And it's because it's been a journey, and it's been constant pivots. And so we didn't just, you know, this didn't just pop into our mind one day of like, hey, let's ship murder mysteries. That sounds like a great idea. You know, this started with a T-shirt business that was floundering quite some time ago, back in 2009. And me talking to Derek and saying, or giving him a call and saying, hey, you know, I'm seeing all these adventure races, and you know, I just opened up Immense Health and I saw a full page ad. I know how much that costs. There must be something happening here. I've got a whole box. Actually, it wasn't a box. I have a whole garage full of T-shirts, and I can't sell them. Are you interested in starting an obstacle race event? And he agreed. And the whole idea was that we'd be able to sell all the T-shirts that were in my garage and give them away for free to participants in the event. And so we launched the event in 2010, and the event was called Run for Your Lives. And when we started the event, the whole idea was that it was just going to be an obstacle race. Then it went from that to thinking about the logo Run for Your Lives, you're running away from something. And it was like, well, there's zombies. Like look at the kind of emerging genre, emerging themes right now, Walking Dead. Like zombies is about to have a moment. And so that's what Run for Your Lives was. It was a 5K obstacle course race where you donned a flag football belt. You had three flags. The flags were your life, and you ran away from 200 zombies along a 5-kilometer post-apocalyptic themed obstacle race course. And it was interesting. It was a lot of lessons learned. It grew like crazy after our first event. We wound up doing 13 events the next year, and then we had 35 events planned for the following year. But much like life and business, and especially first-time business with something that's scaling, a lot of mistakes were made. And so, you know, looking back at WarWear, the mistake was if you build it, they don't necessarily come. So you need a product that has a compelling value proposition. And then the next mistake was when they do start coming, you need a lot of things in place to be able to manage that type of scale. And so that was WarWear, that was Run for Your Lives. And fast forward 3 years, you know, that there was a collapse of that in 2013. Fast forward to 2016, we really just started to look to do it again, and said, you know, same types of principles, same types of models. Look across the industry at different types of themes and experiences that people are gravitating towards. You know, 2016 was escape rooms and interactive theater, and obstacle races were still kind of out. And that was Hunt to Killer 1.0. We transformed a 200-acre campground into a living crime scene, and sold the event out and immersed people inside of a real physical universe for a 3-hour experience and an overnight party.
Well, and the scale of that too, by transforming that into your current iteration versus having people at an event, can be a little challenging to scale.
Yeah, and that's exactly right, and that's the reason that we did pivot the company. You know, we looked at Run for Your Lives, and we said, well, there were times that we were able to grow this event to $2 million for a single weekend, and you put 15,000-20,000 people through. It's kind of just like this conveyor belt. Well, Hunt to Killer was completely different. It took Derek a year to build this brilliant game design, and the game design was very specific to that venue, you know, using the terrain and the woods and the cabins. And then, you know, we sold the event out because we had to put a limit at it. We can't break that or provide that escapism, right, or break reality if there's too many people. So, you know, we look at the bank account. We had just made 60,000. There's 10,000 left over after the event, and we're like, man, this is fun, but this isn't going to scale. And so that, you know, that started kind of the pivot number one, which is, okay, we've got product market fit. You know, people want immersive experience. They want to connect, you know, on a deeper level. They want to put their technology, their phones down. So with that known, you know, what business model is out there that could provide the type of distribution we're looking for? And that's, you know, again, going back to the subscription box, you know, that was the platform or the business model that we chose to scale the company.
Hey, On Brand listeners. We talk about a lot of brand building topics here on the show, from developing strong brands to brand stories to building engaged superfans for your brand, both internally and externally. If these are topics that you're working through or struggling with, I'd love to help. I regularly schedule one-time or ongoing brand coaching sessions with clients based on their unique needs. Are you building a new brand? I'd love to help. Struggling with rebranding? I'd love to help. Do you want to create an engaged community around your brand? I'd love to... You get the idea. I've worked with clients of all shapes and sizes, from Fortune 500 companies to small businesses and startups. I've also interviewed hundreds of experts right here on the On Brand podcast and written 2 books. I can apply all of this to the challenges that you're struggling with. To learn more about working personally with me, Nick Westergaard, go to nickwestergaard.com, that's Westergaard with 2 A's, or email me at nick@branddrivendigital.com. Now back to the show.
So talk for a bit beyond the business case of it, how you built the brand. And you talked about breaking character, and it's such a fascinating aspect of this conceit, because your brand is very interesting in that it almost has an aspect of not breaking character to it, or certainly there's that kind of reveal of the overall conceit. How did you arrive at how to talk about this to people? What the name was, the other key brand touch points?
Yeah, I think, you know, going back to the name initially, we wanted something that was descriptive in the title without, you know, hitting you right on the nose. And Hunt a Killer just kind of made sense. It was actionable. It was, you know, look at Run for Your Lives. Like, you know immediately kind of what it is. You can get a flavor for it. You might not know it's zombies, but you know it. You know you're going to be running. You know, Hunt a Killer, you might not know exactly what you're doing or how you're doing it, but you know immediately that you're hunting for something, or it's investigative, or it's some sort of participatory experience. And so, you know, it really started off with trying to figure out what is that name. And after the name, it's really been about finding a voice and really starting to understand. And the voice has evolved too. That's been, you know, our marketing efforts, our branding efforts have really evolved over the past 3 years. And it's been interesting to watch that, because in the early days, Hunt a Killer was very, very much in your face. It was very much, you know, do you think you have what it takes? You know, are you ready to be challenged? Are you ready to be an investigator? And today it takes on a very different tone. But that's, you know, that's really been the journey of the name and the brand.
So I think that's fascinating, because voice is so important, especially in a brand that, I mean, you're building it online, but then you are sending people something. So it has to transcend all of the different touch points. So that's so key. So what made you, I think that turn that you just talked about, the shift in voice is interesting too, of, you know, the more in your face. What made you rethink brand voice, which was something that you had so specific? What made you think that our brand voice might not be quite right?
Well, I think it, for the time, it was right. And this is going to sound weird, because it's not a new product and it's not a new experience. But we believed that by changing the brand voice, we can actually increase the total addressable market. And same product, same everything else, but increase the total addressable market, because we thought or felt that by evolving the voice, we can kind of break out of the niche. You know, very early days for us, it was 35 to 45, up to 55 year old females. Like, that was our primary demographic. And these are people who are, you know, watching Dateline and 2020 and, you know, consuming a lot of those podcasts that you listen to today. And, you know, they wanted to be challenged. You know, growing up, they were always thinking they'd be an investigator. They grew up with Nancy Drew. And so we had a certain way of speaking to that audience that really resonated. Well, we didn't believe that opportunity or that niche market was large enough to get to where we were going and where we're still going today. And so really starting to soften it up and, you know, talk more about putting down your cell phone, bringing your family around the table. Like, we already have Killer in the brand name. So, you know, trying to soften it up is already hard enough. Trying to make this a family experience is already hard enough, but, you know, we really started to kind of back off of those more aggressive tones.
Well, that's interesting. And, you know, a lot of times I think we struggle with voice because it feels like a very and it is an abstract construct to talk about. But how you just grounded that in terms of the business implications of something seemingly as abstract or what some might write off as inconsequential, you have very grounded reasoning for. And I think, like you said, you can pull in so many of those other macro trends that are really advantageous for your product in terms of, you've mentioned it a few times, and I think that's another appealing thing, especially being a parent right now, that many of us are struggling with is how many times over the course of all of this that we've said, put down your phones. Would you put down your phones? And that's a huge aspect there as well. So I mentioned this a little bit earlier, but you've, and especially with being in retail stores coming up, you have a lot of different brand touch points. What is key in those to bringing about a cohesive hunt-a-killer brand experience?
Yeah, I think it's the easiest thing to identify and the hardest thing to execute, which is just, and that's everything in life, right? Like when we talk about efficient businesses, you know, the easiest thing is communication, and the hardest thing to execute is communication. When it comes to branding, it's consistency. And the reason that I say it's the easiest thing to understand, because we've got style guides and we've got, you know, color pixels, like we have all these things that articulate and outline exactly how the brand is supposed to look, how the brand is supposed to feel. And we have documents upon documents that tell us like how we're supposed to design it, how the copy is supposed to be written, how it's supposed to make you feel. But to execute that across an entire organization is a completely different thing. Because at the end of the day, like when we talk about brand, and I think this is where a lot of people get confused, because when you think about brand, you immediately go to marketing, right? Like it's like, oh, it's brand. Oh, brand, marketing owns brand. What? Not really. Cause brand is how a name or how a trademark or how something from a company makes you feel. Like that's their brand. The brand is who they are, which transcends marketing. It goes from marketing to product to operations to customer service. It goes across everything. So, you know, for us, the most important thing is certainly consistency. It's also the most difficult and most challenging thing to execute against.
Yeah, I mean, there's so much in there. I mean, and especially the idea of all of this is how it makes you feel, but the execution is everything, and that's where It's so easy to get distracted along the way. So keeping those touch points aligned, even as you transcend different channels, I think is especially challenging and impressive also. And like you mentioned, style guides, are there other practices that are beyond the do's and don'ts of the brand style guide that you think helps keep brand at the forefront and not just, as you said, in marketing?
Well, I think there's two things. As you were asking that question, my brain went in two different directions. And the first is who is actually doing the design? And I can give you a funny debate from the company and something that it's actually probably still recent and an outstanding issue, which is who designs the boxes, which team or which department. And the other thing that I think is important with style guides are the words themselves. And when I looked at our style guide, what I thought was very interesting, and maybe this isn't everybody's style guide and I'm just late to the game, but there was a lot more words than I would have thought in a style guide. And I don't mean words like don't use this, don't put the, you know, what not to do with our logo and throwing it in a whole bunch of different colors, which is very standard from a design standpoint. But the words and the articulation of what the brand actually means, how it should resonate, examples of copy that should be used, that flows through everything. It flows through our marketing messages. It flows through the experiences and the products themselves. And so I think that, you know, it, again, kind of going back to that brand, my mind always used to go to trademarks, and it used to go to service marks, and it used to go to logos and things like that. And so, you know, style guides to me were always, how should the logo be representative? What is the width? What is the color? What is, you know, what are you not to do with it? But it's so much more than that, and especially at our company. And then the interesting challenges with that, and especially when we start talking about transcending just marketing, is you know, we've had it's an ongoing debate, I think, which is, who designs our boxes? We developed this amazing retail experience, and it hits the shelves in a few weeks. And the whole idea there is, you know, marketing sells the boxes. So marketing should develop the boxes. Well, I don't know. Is that true? And if we can execute against brand voice and everything else, like, you know, which department is better equipped? The one that just developed the story and understands exactly kind of what it should look like and what it should feel like, or the people that know how to sell it. These are challenges we're still dealing with, but these are interesting, complex issues that all deal with brand.
Absolutely. And I'm sure that there are folks listening out there that exact dynamic that you just described is unfolding, whether it's boxes or point of sale or all sorts of other important brand touch points. And at the risk of finding a hippy-dippy wrapper to put around all of it, I think at the very least, they're conversations that should be had beyond just assumptions either way. So I think that it's, above all, people that should be talking more that don't always. So that is a good connecting of those dots. Ryan, as we start to wrap up here, what is a brand that has made you smile recently?
I think that the brand that always makes me smile, whether right or wrong, has really been Tesla. And I think Tesla has demonstrated truly what brand is and what brand voice is. And certainly I've been really thinking about this a lot lately of what is the differentiator between brands that make it and brands that don't. And you know, what's been really interesting is a lot of brands that you feel that resonate with you and you feel close to. A lot of them have the name of the founder in it. So, you know, think about growing up Ford, think about Kellogg, think about Walt Disney and Disney World and things like that. And it's because you've got this connection. And I feel like it's almost a deeper connection. And we don't name companies after ourselves anymore, but like I feel like that's a part of it. And then I look at Tesla, and Tesla is doing exactly that. Like, love him or hate him, Elon. Like, the brand is him. The Tesla brand is Elon Musk. And so, like, it might be a binary reaction, but it is an authentic and genuine brand. And that makes me smile just from a marketing and branding standpoint.
That is awesome and a great story and a great reminder about the brand name, too, even with a critical figure at the center of things, that they wanted it to be about something else. So, Ryan, where can folks go? I usually say go to learn more about who you are and what you do, but I feel like in this case, where can folks go if they want to hunt a killer?
Sure. So the website is huntakiller.com, and you can go there and register and apply for membership. You know, some other interesting things are we've got a partnership with Lionsgate. We're launching on Monday a Blair Witch subscription, so we're really excited about that. And all that can be found at huntakiller.com.
That sounds amazing, a Blair Witch edition. I just don't want to end up standing in the corner. It's not how you want that to go.
Yep.
Well, we will link up to all of that in our show notes. Ryan, thanks for being on brand with us.
Thanks for having me, Nick.
And as a reminder, if you liked what you heard, if what we said made you smile, remember to head over to iTunes, Apple Podcasts, Spotify, or wherever you like to listen. Please take a moment and rate and review the podcast. Help others find the show. Until next week, I am Nick Westergaard, and I'll see you on the internet.
This podcast is heard along the Marketing Podcast Network. For more great marketing podcasts, visit marketingpodcasts.net.